Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 30th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening, we have Walter Wangren Jr. Session number 98-2, it's titled Spirituality and Story, Hospitality Part 2. Room, let's listen in.
Here so that people moseying in won't miss stuff. I'm about to start. Are you there, Jeff? My name is Walt Wangren. I've been doing a sort of a series on hospitality. Yesterday, I did a little bit of definitional work with it, but it's so much a part of our conversation in the village right now. We had a sermon on it last night, which was just a very embracing sermon. I'm going to talk a little bit about room today, and those of you who were here for Chris's sermon last night, I think we'll see some parallels, that the people themselves make the space and they make the room. And this morning, Fred Niedner spoke about hospitality as well in the Bible session. It'll crop up, and we find that there's a kind of a chord-like echoing person to person. It's really amazing how that happens. We may say the same thing, but not quite the same way, or what we say fits together. Yesterday, I said that there were five elements that I was going to pay attention to, five elements that I recognize as a part. I'm just chit-chatting at this point, so if you need to interrupt by walking straight to your chair and not embarrassing yourself, you can do that. I said there are five elements, and I'd pay a little attention to each one each day. I don't pretend to be comprehensive, and what I think I will do with a little bit of biblical teaching each time is to use story, which sometimes it seems to me, as people know, communicates ever so much more deeply than propositional language may, because of the way it carries you like Elijah's chariot, I think. But my friend Fred Niedner has always opened with a little hilarity. He's given us some pleasure. And I've been opening giving myself some pleasure. Well, I just finished a manuscript, honestly, just before I left home to lead a cruise and to come here. And it's a manuscript that deals with Christmas in a variety of ways. And so one of the things I've done throughout here is to write some new carols. And this one won't quite be a carol. I call this actually a canticle. It isn't exactly that either, since a canticle usually draws the words directly out of Scripture, and this doesn't. It draws the story from Scripture. And I've given myself, honestly, for me, Holden has been one of these blessed places where I can present writing that isn't yet done and not feel that I'm endangering myself. This is just the first draft. Or you might understand what I'm talking about, you know, because this is not necessarily the way it's going to end up. Once I spent a whole summer, not a whole summer, my whole time in this summer reading a novel, The Crying for a Vision, and the response of the people was so blessed for me and for Than that we were able to talk long, and I made some significant revisions. This won't be a whole time, but as people come in, this is the, just come on in. Yeah, there are chairs here, or are you saving that one? Are you? You're saving it?
No? Yes, thank you.
Pardon?
Yes.
For her?
Yes.
Oh, that's good. I was getting worried. She came near and near. And there's some space upstairs. Okay, let me read this while you move around. Don't worry about it. It's called The Angels of Advent, and it's in two parts. It has an Advent feel, and then, well, you'll see. In the days of the angels, the hair on the necks of the people, didn't it stand like a static? In the days of the angel, the air at their ears, the cloud in the heavens, didn't it crack like a solid? In the days when the angels dropped, discharging news in the troposphere, could such electric language not have shot the nerves of the firmament with signs, white words, and understanding? Skin, the abdomen, and deep the human womb must have been tympanic then. Ho, in the days when archangels spoke, wasn't the scent of the weather ozone, tasting of seltzer and ions? And the look of the air thereafter, wasn't it crystalline, cleaner, dimensioned by nitrogen oxides, even as somebody's breathing swells with well-being? Wasn't the breeze of the evening green? Surely the people perceived that angels were imminent, speaking. Now, if you didn't understand that, you will this. A son Now there's a bolt to strike an old man dumb. 100 bidders in the courtyard, Jews devout at the hour of incense, should have been shocked in their nostrils, charged by a nitrogenous excitement, their blood a rush of bubbles. A son, capital S. Let a maiden grab her skirts and run. Let citizens stare after her, stunned, wondering why modesty goes forking through the streets, her knees indecently aflame, her hair unpinned, a fume on the wind. Cousin, cousin, I've such a thing to tell you. A virgin son. And the father who had not engendered it sprang from his pillow, the crack of prophecy ringing in his ears. Surely Nazareth was startled with that man. Surely Galilee, surely Rome at such an impossible pop of lightning moaned in her sleep. A savior. Then all the stars, the wheeling galaxies streamed down, exploding songs of fire across the firmament, sheeting the fields of the shepherds in a flaming rain. Gloria roaring, Gloria in Altissimus Deo, the storm of heaven striking earth, all angels in a fusillade. Could anyone have stayed asleep when the whole air burned electric blue and every hair on every head was singed? Well, if they did, they smelled the smoke in the morning and did not understand. It was themselves whom God had scorched. But the leaves grew greener in their season. The vines were nourished by the nitrogen. Oh, grapevines comprehend an angel's discharge. And vineyards that year produced a wine so red that fools who lifted glasses to the sun were made uneasy by the crimson lens and the dim suspicion they were drinking blood. Part two. This part I really believe. I would like to talk about this a long time, but it's not our lesson. So I'll just read this and see what you get from it. But the salmon shooting from the shattered water knows, and the falcon on her shelf of wind in the blink before she stoops, and the doe who suddenly lifts her face from a bank of fern, twisting her ears like dishes, and the prairie dogs all standing watch on the tableland, erect as pepper shakers. And the ant twiddling her feelers in the universe. And the rabbit caught in the gloaming of the cougar. And the krill upheaving on the advent of ocean water that precedes the gray whale. All of these at the terminal nerves of their beings know Kairos, the fullness of time, that the storm of the Lord is at hand. They long for the crack of liberty of all creation, groaning and intensity of wakefulness. They have unsullied senses. Watch them. Call them kin. O ye nations, let these be your angels. I kind of think that might fit with what Larry is doing.
Yeah.
I think so. So I've eaten up a good portion of my time. Thank you. Thank you. The five elements that I indicated yesterday I would talk about. Number one is some of the source, the attitude. Here's the chair. The attitude, the source, the spiritual source from which one is capable and right in being hospitable to others. I talked about that yesterday. Today I want to talk about room of these five elements. I think all five of these have something to do with hospitality. The room that we create, the space we create, both physically and spiritually, in which to invite people. In which to invite. I told you yesterday, and you've heard this several times now, that the words that we use that develop into our word hospitality, whether it's Greek word or the Latin, means, hospes in Latin means stranger, it means guest, and it means host. There's a blurred activity going on here, which indicates, by the way, I'm going to have to talk faster, but it indicates that these are not just flat, static issues, but that hospitality is always a dramatic and a moving thing. And one of the things that moves in it, because these words have that ambiguity, is the relationships that are formed. In Greek, the xenos I mentioned last time, which also means stranger, and or foreigner, or sojourner, also means guest, also means host, also means enemy. So there can be a progression here, a development of relationship when hospitality is afoot. I said that. And so so room today and tomorrow, food is very often a part of it. As I said, the covenantal act of eating together. And then after food, talk. So I some talk. That's what I will talk about tomorrow. And in that, I'll say something about spirituality and story, which has been the continuing head in my activity here, what talk we do. And then finally is service, ministration, you know, ministers, serving, kneeling and helping people with their feet and things like that. We'll talk about the service, ministration. I keep saying that. Do you think if you put an AD in front of it, it should still be service? Yeah, okay. How many of you are parts of organizations like universities? And yeah, okay. So are they serving? Just a thought. And when they do, whom are they serving? Just a thought. Today, room. And what I'd like to do, I'm going to use two words. One from the Hebrew, this rachav, depending. I'm going to use that, which can be translated room, and it appears in two forms in the Old Testament. I'd like to use that as an identifier for us for three different characteristics that this space may have as we invite people into it. Then in the New Testament, I'm going to use the word menein or meno, which is actually a verb, which means things like I abide, I stay, I continue, I dwell, we dwell. And it becomes a noun in Jesus' last discourse with his disciples. This is the plural exactly as it appears when he talks about many rooms, many dwelling places, many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. So it also has that quality. And what I'm going to do is to speak through this. Every once in a while I might slip into story and you might catch me at it. When I do, then you can put your pens down, that's okay. And if you didn't pick pens up in the first place, it's the best way I have of embracing you by the story. And then I will surely end with one that gathers some of the thoughts that we've done, all three of us that I mentioned and others have done now for a little while in hospitality. This is a little bit of teaching as we go on, and let me story this. You can see here the seven characteristics, which are not complete, that I suggest we might be aware of when we create space into which to invite the stranger, both the spiritual and real space. Isaac and Rebecca. It would be very good for me to talk at length about the relationship between Isaac and Rebecca, because I think between the two of them, Rebecca had the stronger spirit. You really watch those things. It's a small cycle in the Old Testament. We have longer cycles for Abraham than Sarah, and we have much longer cycles for Jacob. And the host of that family, Leah, Rachel, and others. And we have a long cycle for Joseph. This is a short cycle. And it's, you know, perhaps some of you know that these various patriarch-matriarch associations were also associated with various parts of land. In those days, stories stuck to the geography, you know. They stuck to the land. Because people stuck to the land. You'd move in and they would talk about the configuration of the land and the weather. That's why we could talk about that pillar of salt, you know, which had been Lot's wife, because there were things like that in that area where Sodom and Gomorrah were assumed to have been. So Isaac and Rebekah's portion is south of where Abraham's was. Abraham's was around where we see Hebron now, south of Jerusalem. But Isaac and Rebekah were, I guess, you know, you can help me, Fred, or anyone who wants to. It's what we call the Gaza Strip today, isn't it? That place where the Bible said Philistines had begun to build cities. And among those cities was one called Gerar, G-E-R-A-R. The king of that city, it must be a name that was passed down from king to king, was Abimelech, because it's the same name I think Abraham bumped into when he and Sarah were on their way down to Egypt. This, if you see the Mediterranean Sea here in front of me, this is the land that's to the southeast, the land of the southeast strip along that sea. It's a semi-eretic. Sometimes it's terrible desert. Sometimes the rains come and it's able to grow. So it's a semi-desert. That's where Isaac and Rebekah's stories are stuck. They're there. They're right there. And Gerar is there, and the king is named Abimelech. And there are some parallels between them and Abraham and Sarah. Rebekah, strong-willed, one of the best examples, by the way, of hospitality. I don't have time to tell you about that, you know, how she responded when people came to the well, and she did more than she was asked to do. Nevertheless, oh, I should talk to you about the relationship with that king Abimelech. Because, you know, here is Isaac, who is exactly like his father when they move into the territory. And, of course, this woman, Rebecca, is a striking individual. She's striking for looks as well as for talent and abilities like that. And of course, Isaac knows that. And Isaac is out to save his own, whatever you want to call it, rear end, something. So that he's afraid that if he said, this is my wife, and people got the strong urge to have a relationship with her, that they might kill him first. So what he says is, this is my sister. We can talk about that another time. He's saving himself, and he's putting his wife in harm's way. But you know, when Abimelech starts talking to her and finds out that this is his, then he blows his mind. Because there was more morality in that king than Isaac was willing to it. Because at least there was more fear in that king that if he had fooled around with someone else's wife, he'd be under a judgment, you know. Abimelech from his own gods. Abimelech. Abimelech. M-L-K. Where we lived in the inner city, there are boys named Malik. And it means king. It means king. Abimelech means my father is king, or the king is my father, or something like that. Well, this immediately created some stress, you understand, between Isaac and Abimelech. And there was already stress, you know, because Abimelech brings Isaac in and says, why didn't you tell me? Well, we don't have the words of Isaac very much at that point. But, you know, the Lord blessed that sucker anyway, and his flocks and his herds were growing, which is more dangerous. You know, they lived on the edge. This is a sort of a class thing. They lived on the edge of the city. And the flocks and the herds were growing. He was prospering, and that made the people in the city nervous. And if Abimelech did not send him away for the sin he did with his wife, the sin that Isaac did with his wife, well, he got more nervous when this man got strong. And then he said, you must get out of here. And he threatened him. I mean, he used his own servants, which were warriors, as well as herdsmen and so forth and so on, and said, get out of here. And so Isaac went out. He left. And where he came to a place where his father had dug a well and the people of Gerar had filled it in. He said to his servants, open that well up. And they did. Not only did they get the stuff out of the well, but it began to flow clean water. As soon as the word got back to Gerar, here came Abimelech's soldiers and servants. And they shook the spears in the faces of Isaac. And they said, get out of here. That's ours. That's our water. You're too close. And Isaac, you know, this is the sort of thing I would do. Walk away mumbling. He moved. He moved with his whole household. He went farther. But he named that well before he went. He named it Esek. He named it Esek, which is friend, contention, something like that. Yeah, something like that. Not a good name and not a good place to be. He went farther, and this time he asked his people to dig the well, and they dug it, and the Lord blessed him the second time. This ought to say something to you about God. Just generous. And that well flowed. And immediately when the word got way back to Gerar now, they came thundering out once again. They said, that's our water, that's our water. You get out of here. And so, you know, Isaac did two things. But he named it Sitna. Striving. Enmity. Bad blood. Went farther and farther into this desert area, one more time built a well. This time it also flowed water. For the third time it flowed water. Think about that. And this time nobody came and challenged him, and he named the well Rehoboth. He named it Rehoboth. He said, for the Lord has given us room. The Lord has given us a space in which to dwell. And I take from that, as I'm weaving this stuff together, all of you who are responsible for the place into which you invite the stranger. I think that one thing absolutely necessary is you take time, first of all. This is a place. Now, this is a space. This is a spaciousness in which there is no conflict. It is called Rehoboth. And I will just say this. I'll drop this into your minds. So that those of you who are responsible in congregational communities or Holden community or individual familial communities or the vast church community will realize that you do not invite people into places where there is striving and contention. What sort of invitation is that? If you are not hospitable unto one another, if we, you know, in my parish, I could always tell when they were having fights because they got Christianer. Well, they got so Christian that they said to one another, I won't fuss with her, I just won't talk to her.
Yeah.
And I could see they started sitting on far parts of the church. They make a point. It's like two northern ends of two magnets, huh? They would come and they just walk around each other. There was some kind of burning going on the inside, and maybe sitting in our attic, but if you invite someone into that, now how is that person to find peace and hospitality? One of the most revealing things for me, I bumped into this as I was working on the Book of God, is how that same word, this same Hebrew word, reappears. Only this time when it reappears, dear people, it makes a person that place. It makes a person that place. This is in Joshua chapter 2, and Joshua is now on the east side of the Jordan River, and he's preparing to cross into the Promised Land, and I'm sorry, he's going to take it by war, and he's going to take that key city first, that one that sits central, west of the Jordan, which is Jericho, and he sends two spies. You know this story, don't you? He sends two spies into the city, and somehow or other they meet up with a prostitute who is herself in some respects, not altogether in those days, something of an alien in the city herself. Not altogether, but somewhat. Yes, she is. And she's the one who takes them in. She's the one who takes them into her place, which you know is in the wall. There are all kinds of rooms built in that wall. She must be high in that wall because she can come up onto the roof of where she is. Perhaps that's the actual top of the wall itself. And you know what happens, that somehow or other there is wind that goes through the city in the evening that says something about these people that are so numerous they look like grasshoppers. They look like locusts covering the eastern shores of the Jordan, which is terrifying to the people. Jericho. And nevertheless, somehow she invites these two in. And when the wind gets around that they're there, they come knocking on her door. And she takes them up to the roof and covers them over and hides them. Hiding place. There is a song, I think, of that. My hiding place, the Lord is my... She hides them and creates for them now a place of physical protection. A place of physical protection. And then goes and speaks for them without naming them to keep the soldiers away from finding them. Surely they would have been killed. And what is her name? And what is her name? Say it loud.
Rahab.
Rahab. Her name is Room. Her name is Spaciousness. It may be a person who grants that kind of invitation. I know that. I know people who, when they invited me in, I knew what they were inviting me into was their spirit. You know that too. There were times when my mother was the space that was complete protection for me when I was very young and in danger of death. She invited me into that space, which was her presence. And that's what this room does, creates a place of protection. So not only is there no conflict within, but there is a kind of a protection from without. I put these two names down here because they attach to church activity and the space that we create, a place of sanctuary, which is not far apart from the way in which we name our church, the nave, the sanctuary, the place we worship, that holy place, going back to the Old Testament. I mentioned this the other day too. It's also a place of asylum. We don't use this word a lot anymore because we've lost its real meaning. Now we mean it's a place where we'd like to put people that we don't want too near to us. This is where we put people away, not where we invite them in. But you know that. You know politically that the churches have from time immemorial, all the way back to when they could get to those cities of refuge, that's the other word, refuge, that they were granted asylum, protection. And so the foreigners who come to this land are sometimes granted political asylum. And you know what we don't do? It's not here. We don't say, okay, for you to come into our asylum, you have to become a Christian. We just invite them. All we're doing is making the stranger or the foreigner a guest in our place. And that's motion. I gotta keep talking. But then comes this beautiful reversal. In the very same story, I move a little bit farther. When she gets ready to sneak them out at night, to sneak them out over the wall so they can get back to Joshua and tell what they have seen, she... How many women are in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew?
Four.
And every one of them had some kind of struggle in which she showed strength. Every one of them. And this comes the strength of Rahab here. She bargains. She who granted the spacious protection against any kind of cut attack from enemies now bargains. And what about me, she says. And they respond and they say, look, if you hang that scarlet cord from your window when the time comes for us to attack, we promise you in the name of our God, you will not die. We'll show you back the same. Look at the reversal. Look what's happening. Who's host? Who's guest? What's happening here? We'll show you back the very same protection that you have shown us. And you know, I imagine, I wrote it this way in the book of God. I wrote it from the perspective of the king of Jericho, who's been sweating these days, you know, when people have been marching around. He can't understand the mystery of their marching around and what they're doing. They're not attacking. That'll drive him crazy, anyone who's born in a foxhole. You know, you can't do anything. You just can't do anything. And then all of a sudden the trumpets blow and they go around and the whole wall's beginning to shake. And here's the king on the top of his wall. I imagine that the stones just crumble and fall out underneath his feet. And down he goes. But as he's going down, I don't know, maybe he's upside down, maybe he's twirling around. As he's falling down, this king, to the ground, where he's not going to get up again, he looks and he sees this one finger of the wall standing. This one pinnacle. This one beautiful feather standing up from the ground. And he sees the window, and out of the window he sees that cord, and he says to himself, just before he hits the ground and perishes, he says, Rahab, a prostitute? Gone. What kind of a death must that be? Why does she get to live? I'm the king. I'm the, administrator. I'm the administrator. I don't know why I'm doing that. Forgive me. I don't know what it means. Boom, he's gone. But look what happens. Look what is given in return. And now we move from the concrete, from walls, from space, which never should be forgotten. We add all this together to something spiritual. She's granted place in the family. Here's this progression. Rahab, who was of Jericho, who was a prostitute, marries Solomon. How do I say that, Fred? Salmon. In Hebrew.
Solomon?
Yeah, Salmon in English. Can anyone just tell me? Let's just say it's Solomon. I don't think it's salmon.
Solomon.
Solomon. That's it. She marries Solomon, who is of the tribe of Judah. Yes! And they have a baby. And the baby's name is, anyone know? Boaz. Boom! What kind of invitation? You know, we say over and over again that hospitality creates a dramatic progression of relationship. What's happening here? She's invited into the family. The woman is granted an identity within these people. She's kin. She's more than kin. She marries Boaz. Boaz grows up and marries that other strong woman, one of the four, whose name is?
Ruth.
And they have a baby whose name is?
Obed.
And they... They have a baby whose name is?
Jesse.
And they have a baby whose name is?
David.
Now just pause. Oh ye churches. Oh ye Holden. Wherever it is that you realize that you may be hospitable to others, see what sort of invitation this is. Come and eat. And there may be the potential that where we will not be fighting one another, where we create protection, that you shall not die, that you may join. And so it goes possibly from enemy to stranger to guest to member. You may join and with us find an identity and a place with our people, our family, and yea, even in our holy history. What a gift. I don't have the time, but I wish you would, in the succeeding days here, think backward. What would destroy that gift? What would make us mute before that? What would keep us from being able to allow this thing also to grow among us? Our daughter Talitha just got married. I did it. I married her to Raymond Washington. And in a certain sense, Raymond was first of all a stranger in our house, very much. Now, so was our daughter Talitha. but we gave Raymond space, and we talked, and we fed, and he ate. Yeah, you're right. And he ate. And he is a member of our family. If our history has any holiness about it because of our relationship to God, it is also Raymond's. and he knows it. I've said it. Let me jump to the New Testament and keep building. A place, a place, a place, a place, but I don't have the space to write that. I want to use this word meno. As I told you, as a verb, it is I dwell, I continue, I stay. I'm sure I'll get, I'll get some others as I go. Dwell, continue, remain. Stay. What?
Remain.
Remain.
Abide.
Abide. Oh, I like that, don't you? Ever since we were little children, always in the farmer, you know, when at the end of whatever worship service you had at night, you always in darkness, hold thou thy cross before my closing eyes. I was ready to die every night. Abide with me. Oh, what a beautiful word. I've had the luxury, actually, of teaching the Gospel of John at Valparaiso. And for me, in my particular spirit, which tends toward the poetic, which is my mother's spirit, actually, John is the perfect book, because John will take certain words, I think you know this, and use them over and over and over and over. But whenever John builds upon the previous use of that word, they grow. They're like a pregnancy. They add more and more. They grow, and these meanings that they gather together sometimes sound as if they're in conflict, but they never are. They enrich that word from the beginning to the end. So I'd like to do that for you with this word, which becomes the word rule, this dwelling. This word dwelling, and quickly go through. John uses this word much more than I'm going to give it to you right now, but I'm going to touch several major points. A place. In John chapter 1, John the Baptist, this happens twice, raises that old choppy bony finger, that skinny fellow who smells of sweat, like he just went up to whatever, Copper Falls, and didn't wash when he came down. That offensive figure raises that bony figure and he points at this fellow who's walking over the hills, walking over the ridge. I see that in my mind. And I know it's wrong because I see Jesus like a white Christ candle in a sort of serenity coming over the greensward. Can't be right. Points and says, "Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." The second time that he does that, there's a wind starts behind him. And it's like, whew, whew. Two of his disciples just break free. They hear that, and I don't fully understand what's taking place here, but they pass right by John, and Jesus, who doesn't meet John at that point, nor talks to him, just keeps on walking, suddenly has two tails. So you see Jesus walking around, and these people going behind like this, not quite sure what to do. This is the Lamb of God. They've forgotten John. Well, they haven't forgotten John, but they're on something new here. And the reason I do that is because Jesus will constantly in John, over and over again, put it to people. There's always that face-to-face confrontation. You can't stand formally and back. Again and again, Jesus sweeps around. You know that there's an eye contact. He says to Pontius Pilate, "Do others say this to me, or do you say this?" And constantly puts people in that association with him where there has to be a sort of a shocking, you feel tingling, shocking response. So here is Jesus walking along, and I think of these two guys. If some of you know the play Waiting for Godot, and you have any sense of who Patsu and Vladimir are as they're walking across the stage, I see these two guys coming behind Jesus, and then Jesus does this. "What do you want? What are you looking for? Take. It's a very important question. In John, it's a terribly important question, although it's very simple and we often overlook it. Turns around and says, "What are you looking for? Why do I know it's important?" It's the very same question, so that you get what I'm delivering to you here. It's the very same question that Jesus asks Mary Magdalene when she's weeping outside of the tomb, except it's in the singular. What are you looking for? Whom do you see? It's the same question. So think of the weight of that question, although if you just began reading John and you're still at chapter 1, you don't know it yet, but you will. So Jesus turns around and asks this laden question to people who have no idea. And says, "What are you seeking? Who are you seeking?" Either translation. And this is what they say, and this is what I want you to think about. They say, it's curious, you know, I have to think about this a long time to understand it, but they say, "Where are you staying?" That's what they say. They don't say, "We're looking for you," they say, "Where are you staying?" And then you know that Jesus' response was purely Johannine. It's this double thing, "Come and see." These are very important words in John because they're the beginning of faith. Come and see. Look for the manifestation. Nevertheless, let me go back to that question. Where are you staying? The more that I read that, the more I hear the cry of humanity. I hear it in 1,000 languages in 1,000 ways. It's people saying, where are you, God? Where are you, God? I want to be where you are. Where do you stay? Where do you abide? Where is your dwelling place? Let me be there. And then you understand how sweet that answer is. Come. See. Where are you staying? So what I'm saying here is this place, when we enter into the New Testament with the manifestation of the Messiah, the Christ, part of it is going to be that this is a place where God dwells, where Christ dwells. Now that's what makes this peculiar. Hospitality can happen everywhere. All of this can happen in hospitality. We become the peculiar people when it is a place where we know the Lord dwells. And I say, first of all, by personal desire. We're individuals in that congregation, in this place, in that family, whatever you want to identify. Let me identify a community this way. It's a place where people consciously or unconsciously, verbally or mutually, covenant together, where they indicate somehow or other that they have established an enduring relationship one with another. Anyway, so this is a place where the individuals have sought God, have sought Jesus, and in that seeking begins the process of faith. That's why I write it this way. It develops into the faith where the Lord dwells and honors that faith. In chapter 4, same thing, but here it becomes the corporate invitation, invocation. You remember that in chapter 4, Jesus meets the woman at the well. Skip all that. The woman becomes the first missionary. John is remarkable for this. And one day we ought to talk about what roles women play in John particularly. This is the first missionary. This is the first person who goes to a mass of people and says, I have met someone who has told me everything I have ever done. Could this be the Messiah? Could this be the Christ? And she says it with such fervor. She says it with such passion that this woman, who could have been called a husband killer, I mean, you hang back from people who have married 5 times and their husbands all, whatever, died. Well, think of Rahab. She's the alien. She comes, and she's transfigured enough that they listen to her. And they come out. They come out at her word. Come and see. They come out, and they find Jesus. And right away, what do they say? Come. Stay with us. It becomes the invitation, which in our worship always becomes the invocation. Come. Stay with us. And it's now a whole people. It's a corporate body. And Jesus goes and stays with them how long? 2 days, 3 days. And by the end of that time, they find that woman and they say, you know, and so now there's a good relationship. This is wonderful. And they say, you know, at first it was your word. But now we have seen this one. And now we believe on our own. What a missionary activity. So, let it be a place where God in Christ dwells by personal desire and by invocation, invitation. And you'll notice that over and over again, this is the development of faith. Let me pick this word up a little bit farther on. Oh, I love this part. You all know this. If you don't immediately recognize chapter 8, verse 31 to 36, you will recognize the words because you hear it, those of you that are Lutheran, every October. This is the gospel lesson for the Reformation Sunday again, again. And again, and boy, I gotta talk fast. Here's a portion of it. Verily, verily, if you continue in my word, if you abide in my word, there's a dilemma right away. How do you abide in a word? If you abide in my word, you are aletheia. You are truly my disciples, and you shall know the truth. And the truth shall set you, make you free. A bunch of words in there. A bunch of Johannine words that you must understand. If you abide, if you dwell, if you mellow in my words. What is the word? Logos. What is logos in John? Over and over again, logos is not just. It is not just a series of commandments. This does not just mean obey the commandments that I give you. Even though they're wonderful commandments, two of them, love one another, believe in me. It is not just that. In John, logos is again and again the revelation of God made manifest in the world. That's why Jesus is this utterance of God, this holy cry. Jesus is the Word made flesh. And when Jesus talks about the Word, then, It is this presence of God in the face of Jesus and the action of Jesus Christ. If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. Truly is the same word that we get coming up on the tape. And you shall know, gignosko, you shall know. This is not just confirmation. Although I think confirmation is terribly important, and I'd like to talk about it one day, but this is not confirmation. This is not doctrine. This is what it is. What is your name again? Christine? I'm Walt.
Hi, Walt.
I'd like to get to know you. But I really know Fan best of all. That just popped in my head. It has nothing to do with me. This is the knowledge. It's the knowledge of relationship. You will know the what? Truth. I'm going at this very quickly, but please, in our faith, truth is not a what. What explains our truth, but what is not our truth? And we have to be very careful, because if we think our truth is a what, we'll end up making an idol out of our own doctrine. Our truth is a who. Our truth is a living who. On the night in which he was betrayed, in fact, just after this portion that I'm going to talk to you about in John 14, Philip, Jesus says, "You know where I'm going?" And Philip says, "We don't know where you're going. How can we know?" And Jesus says, "Gee, have I been with you so long, man?" And then declares one of these ego in me, one of these I am passages. I am the way and
truth
and life. And immediately thereafter, well, not immediately, but the next morning, there sits Pontius Pilate saying unto the truth, "What is truth?" What an irony. So, you will know the truth. You'll know me, and I will set you free. And if you don't think that's all together, read farther down to the parable that follows, the little story. Who continues in the house? The son continues in the house. The slave does not continue. If the son makes you free, you are free indeed. Jesus is that son. But this dwelling in a word, this revelation, December 31, 1967, that's New Year's Eve day. I was in Chicago at my parents' house. I'd been going to school down in Miami of Ohio near Cincinnati, and Fan was going to school up in Milwaukee at UWM, and I was in my parents' house on New Year's Eve day doing this. I was thinking to myself, okay, I have courted the woman for a year. What do you think? Should I ask her to marry me? That's what I was doing. On New Year's Eve day, all my family went out to the party, and I stayed home alone, and honestly, I put Beethoven's 7th Symphony on the record player, and I turned it right up. Well, because no one mattered. I mean, it's New Year's Eve day. And I was so scared. I mean, I thought I should marry her, and it's true that I loved her, and she told me that she loved me, although she said it hissingly, I'll tell you that. And so I kept thinking, can I look into the future? I mean, this is a forever thing. This is like I'm standing on the very edge of a, is it okay to walk? On the very edge of a cliff, and I can't see the darkness. And when I say, will you marry me? See, in our minds, there was no choice. It wasn't like, let's test it for a while and then we can divorce. No, I'm sorry. This is it. So I'm going to step off in the darkness, and who knows what she's going to be. And I mean, I knew what she was as we courted it long distance. She was very jet and beautiful. She was skinny. But let me tell you honestly that if you put a sweater on or a sweatshirt, it makes the flesh feel so good when you rub that sleeve up and down. And I used to drive Fan and Hadrian. It was my VW Volkswagen, yellow with a, what do you call it, rag top. And she was the farmer's daughter, actually. We'd drive outside, and she'd sit on the front seat and pull her knees up and take that sweatshirt and pull it down over her knees, and that just broke my heart. That was the most beautiful thing she could do. She didn't know. I almost drove off the road over. Yes, I wanted, but I didn't know what we were going to, and I hurtled back and forth. Back and forth I went with this in my mind. Should I ask her? The next morning, I didn't know. I didn't know if I would or should or could. I got into my VW and I started driving north from Chicago to Milwaukee, and it was snowing, and I didn't care. Because I didn't know what I was going to do. I drove to Milwaukee itself. This is now New Year's Day. New Year's Day, 1968. I drove to Milwaukee. I came to her apartment. I knocked on the door, and she opened it up, and there she had on a sweater. She had a big, bulky knit sweater on. And I went in like this. And I sat down on the sofa, just gloomy. I'm a real romantic. I sat down and I put my feet out like that, and I looked, and she had drawn her knees up underneath that sweater. And I said, "So, okay, do you want to get married?" And she said yes. She did. She just said yes. I thought it was over. Honestly, I that was the crisis. It's done. Good. I sat there. Her sister, Mary, came in and said, "Oh, good, when?" I hadn't thought about that. I thought I was done, and she said yes. And I had to drive that same day in that little VW bug from Milwaukee all the way down to Cincinnati. In those days, you don't have superhighways. None of this 9480 stuff that Mike was talking about. You were over 30. And I was driving around Chicago, and the snow had never quit. It was getting thicker and thicker, and now it's dark. And I looked in my mirror, and I saw, in those days, it was the bubblegum thing, right? You know, I saw that cop. And almost any other time, once in a while, I would see, it would just tighten me up. I smiled. Here's community. Honestly, I pulled over. And the guy came up, and I rolled my window down. And before he could say anything, I said, "She said yes." I wasn't speeding. Honestly, he stopped me because my headlight was out. Any other time, this would have driven me just crazy. I, in fact, years after that, when I had another one and something went wrong, I would just bang on the roof of my car and create dents that I'd look at forever and feel guilty. But when he told me my headlight was out, I didn't care. I was dwelling in her yes. I found a place that New Year's Day that fixed my headlight, and I drove on to Highway 30 going east on my way to Fort Wayne. And the snow got so thick that I was behind these big 18-wheeler trucks that I was driving like this. Snow was coming in on the floorboard, and I remember this as one of the most beautiful, mysterious nights when the darkness of the night itself held untold meaning, stuff that I didn't know, but now I wanted to find out. This was a night of sweet mystery. She said yes. And when I came around Valparaiso, the snow was so thick, I couldn't drive anymore. I got out, went to a phone, called her brother, Melvin Bowman, who lives in Valparaiso. He said, "Come on over." And he gave me all the story of the Bowmans, and I didn't care. Yes, yes, Martin said yes on Sunday. Do you remember that? Some of you were not here. It was a remarkable sermon. Martin said, "God says yes to our no. God says yes. In Jesus, God says unto all of our crap and all of the no's that we do in other people, Jesus makes it yes. God says yes. You dwell in that yes. When you dwell in that yes, you create a place where Christ is the room. Where Christ is the room where the people dwell. That's the place to invite them. Do you understand by now how much we first must look at ourselves to prepare to invite the stranger in? We never cease looking at ourselves and never cease inviting you to both at once. But you look at yourself. I'm in the ELCA. I say, "Oh, ELCA, look at yourself." I was in the Missouri Synod. "Oh, Missouri Synod, look at yourself. That first. Oh, ye Baptists." And then six, and these are quick. Finally, what begins in actual concrete presence, a space, a physical room, also must have concrete manifestation. In John chapter 15, Jesus uses what is as closest to a parable as he gets in John, where he says, "It's by the way, you have to give up reason to read this properly. You cannot be rational and read this. It'll drive you crazy. My daughter is getting her PhD in mathematics. She can't read this." This is where Jesus talks about he is the vine, we are the branches. And those who dwell in the vine bear fruit. Only he goes on and he says, so dwell in me, and I dwell in God, and God dwells in you, and I dwell in you, and we all dwell in each other. It's irrational. There is no logic to that. But it's relational, and it's explosive. I mean, if you want to see what I'm talking about, look at fireworks. Only here, what is made very, very clear, this fruit that we bear is the presence of Jesus Christ now, not just spiritually. I will just say this, and then you cogitate. Not just spiritually, but actually with moments. This is where we really do feed those who are hungry. This is where we really do give drink to those who are thirsty. And the only thing that makes them worthy of our drink and our food is that they are hungry and thirsty. That's the only requirement. We really do dress the naked. We really do take the stranger in action. And then finally this, and then I want to tell you a story. Here this word finally comes in the 14th chapter where Jesus says, I will not leave you. I mean, the whole concept is I will not leave you. I go to prepare a place for you. The room that you create this way, according to these things, shall become the room that already embraces eternity and shall last into eternity. I go to create, I, your host, will create a room for all of you, that where I am, you may be also. So what is established here, what is manifest here, what is in your face here, is really the foretaste and the shining of eternity in this time place. It's the proof of you. It's what causes other people to lay down their arms and to trust you, which is the beginning of faith. And that trust then becomes eternity. Let me tell you a story. Chris mentioned this passage, I think, last week. I wasn't here. But it's Luke 24, 13 to 35. It's the walk to Emmaus of the Cleopas and the other disciple. Fred mentioned it this morning. He talked about it as the point where the guest becomes the host. Have you heard that? I mean, do you immediately realize what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Jesus is the guest. They invite him in, and he becomes the host. He breaks the bread. He does all these Eucharistic kind of things. And then suddenly they realize, their eyes are open, and they realize it was Christ who was the host. Let me tell you the story, and what I'm going to do is tell you a story where the strangers and the aliens become the hosts, which is possible, and where the hosts become the guests. And all I've talked about here, then, is actually mobile and goes with us. It's a remarkable story, and it's one in which I learned, not one in which I taught. At Grace, at the congregation where I was a pastor for so many years, we had a remarkable choir. Oh, I could talk for you now so that you would weep to hear Dee Dee Lawrence, who, by the way, now, this summer, is in Italy singing opera. This is a small inner-city church, people. And I took the choir on tours, and I'd always call ahead and talk to the pastors or whoever, and I would say, this is a very good choir. And they'd always say yes, and they really thought, no, I say, you don't understand. This is a remarkable choir. Yes, they would say. I said, no, well, okay. We would get there and sing, and they'd always come up to us afterward and say, why didn't you tell us? Because it's in the experience, and you can hardly believe how beautiful this choir is from an inner city. And our choir was little kids and their parents and youth, Herman Thomas. When we went down to the south, where we discovered our purpose, Herman was directing. He was a college student. Cheryl, who was usually the director, was playing the piano because we had lost our pianist. We always had a bass, electrified bass and drums. And the adults would sing, and I would speak. On this particular tour, we didn't hardly know what we were in for, but we went south. First night, we sang in Memphis. We sang mostly in white churches. We were all together black, except for me and Fan and two of our kids. The other two were black, of our kids. And so we sang in Memphis, and we went down to New Orleans, and we sang there, which is its own story, but and it would enrich the story I want to tell you, but I can't. Sorry. We went to Galveston, and it was around about Galveston, you know, the people started, you know, they always ask, where are you singing next? Where are you singing next? We're on a bus. We jam that bus, and we would tell them. It was around about Galveston that Fan and I, who always would stay with the pastor, you know, and the pastor's family, they say, where are you singing next? And we tell them about this place in Dallas. And always it went quiet. Oh, they'd say, really? Yes. Really? Ah, well, anything we should know? Well, it's okay. And for some reason, no one said. But Cheryl and I together, and Fan too, got really nervous about what was going to happen in Dallas. I asked Cheryl, as we went through Houston and North, I asked her, should we talk to the choir about this? She said, no, let's wait and see. Now I'm going to tell you what happened. And everything I tell you is fact. This is theology. This is theology where God is the speaker. Theoulogos. God speaks a word. When we got to the church, it was a large complex in the center of the city, and it was so rich, and the city was so green, that when we got off the bus, we thought we smelled perfume. I'm not lying. We thought they could perfume the place. These are inner city kids, okay? We thought they could perfume them. Already some of them are losing their voices. They're not trained at that point. Cheryl and I met a fellow who's this tall and very straight up and down, somewhat officious. He looked at us and he said, come with me. And we followed him, and he realized I was the pastor and Cheryl was the main director. And we went into his office. He turns out to be the vicar. He sits down behind his desk and he does this. He makes a tent with his fingers. And he says to us, you have 20 minutes. I said, what? He says, It's Ash Wednesday, and our program is all based on Lent. It's an hour and a quarter. He says, our pastor is going to preach, they're going to read the Passion narrative, our choir is going to sing, you have 20 minutes. I said, our program is an hour and a quarter. They knew that. He said, you have 20 minutes. Now the pastor, this is the vicar, the pastor came in behind us while we're talking, almost as if he were on some pneumatic air. He did not introduce himself, the vicar did not, he came floating behind us. He floated, and then he went. I remember that he stood in the corner behind the vicar, and we were over here and just looked at us. He didn't say anything. And then he floated out. I mean, that was my impression, so you know, you must understand there's something. So, exactly. And I was so angry because I knew what this was. And so was Cheryl, but she was calmer than I was. She has dealt with this much longer than I have, but she's angry. But I'm furious. We're a black choir. This is a white congregation. And somehow, well, what happened was my friend David Wacker, who's a Missouri Synod pastor, called his friend here and said, choir's coming, okay. And from that point on, I was talking to a secretary. I never talked to this pastor. Somewhere he found out where he couldn't turn it off, we were a black choir. That's what it was. We knew that because when Cheryl and I walked through the kitchen, we saw there were a few people making dinner for us and they did not welcome us. And we know the difference. We know what hospitality is. And I was just furious. Cheryl, I said, give me five songs. I'm going to preach. It was going to be four times between each of her songs. And I was going to tell them in a prophetic way. I was just serious about this. I would preach an Amos sermon. That this is a horrible thing to do to other people. That these are gentle people. These are little. It was burning my mind. She gave me the songs and I went into their library. They had a library. A big library. I mean, with tables and books and things. And a door. And so I paced. Oh, my heaven. I paced in that library, just trembling. And I began to put together. I don't write sermons down. I haven't. I don't. I think them. And I was pacing and putting this thing together in chunks. Pacing back and forth. I think it must have been there 45 minutes. And all of a sudden, the door opened up. And Herman Thomas, Jr. came in. This man has a rich, deep walnut complexion. And he came in and he fell backward in the chair that was there and he burst into tears. He said, I don't want to sing here. He said, I don't think God wants us to sing here. He said, I want to just get on the bus and go away. And he's just bawling. He's just crying. And I said, why? And it turns out that while they were rehearsing in the church, which is just our normal way, up in the chancel, Tony Calhoun had reached to touch the altar. And when Tony reached to touch the altar, this voice came out of the cavernous dark. Don't do that! It was so loud. And it was so commanding that our entire choir snapped. I mean, they snapped to attention because of the voice and what it was. And of course, it was the pastor who now strode forward out of the darkness and let them know what they could and could not do in this space, what they could and could not touch. And he was so forceful at it that the choir just broke. And Herman, who was directing them, dismissed them and walked and found me and fell into tears. This is a college student. He's intelligent. What I did next, I didn't do. I promise you, God did. Because I did not plan this. I knelt down in front of Herman, and I took his hands, and I said, Herman, of all the places we're going to sing on this tour, we've got to sing here. It's the only second tour we ever did. I said, we've got to sing here. And I said, the reason we've got to sing here is because they don't know love. That's what I said. And I said it to him passionately with his hands in my hands until he agreed. He also believed they don't know love and they must know it. Herman, I said, talk to the choir. And he went out and I just stood there. I got a whole new sermon to write. If what I said is true, I have to preach love to them. I have to preach love. And I started thinking of how that would be, and I just stood there, and within 5 minutes, the door opened up again. It was Than. She came in with my supper. When I saw Than, I just burst into tears. Oh, I don't know why. I mean, it was the tension. It was all this stuff. And I just sobbed. And of course, Stan's about this tall. She put this down and came up to me, and I just like sagged over here, and I just cried. And when she went out, I chose John 3:16 because we had a song. We had a song. And although Cheryl hadn't mentioned it, I was going to tell her to sing that. And I thought about that. And I even remember the little bits of sermon that I preached. But I went out after that, and I talked to the whole choir. I didn't eat supper. And they all were going to sing, even though I was losing their voices, because they knew that this is a place that didn't know love. That was the phrase. And they knew that they could bring it. We were put in the balcony. We sat in the balcony looking down on this huge sanctuary of people, and the pastor indeed preached. Boy, you remember that sermon. It was the first of a series which were questions answered from the cross. And the phrase was, you know, it was Jesus, Father, forgive them. But this is how this pastor preached it. Honestly, he said, question from the cross, do you need forgiveness? Answer, yes! And over again, he used this phrase, pour contempt in all your pride, which is from, of course, the hymn. Hi, this is forgiveness. And Herman, sitting up beside me, he nudged me and he pointed to the pew. And in the pew, someone had actually, with a pen, you know, ballpoint pen, chiseled the words, I don't know this. Our choir sees symbols everywhere. He nudged me and he looked and he pointed down. Well, when we got ready to sing, we were surprised. This is how we did it. The first one to walk in, a cappella, all by herself, was Gina Moore. Gina Moore Clark, Dee Dee's auntie, who then was 20 years old and had the most beautiful soprano voice. I can't do what she did, but she walked down, and it was electrifying to the people. I don't think they even knew there was a choir to sing. But alone, all by herself, she started singing. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son of God, that whoever believes in him should have everlasting life. By that point, she was up front. And then Timmy, her cousin, huge Timmy with this tenor voice that I liken to the Chariots of Elijah, came down the aisle singing the very same song while she stood and watched him. And then they met and sang face to face the duet. And they can make those notes bleed. They can make the triad so close that it's like tears squeezed out of music. And when they came for the third time, should have everlasting life. The drum came in, boom, boom, boom. And the men of the choir started, just holy one, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might through him be saved. And at that point, the whole choir came in singing, but not sway. It was their choice not to threaten. They came in straight up singing, no swaying, no clapping. They took their place. Behind them all came me and Cheryl's husband, Philip, because he was the reader and I was the preacher. And then we sat behind them. So the choir was in front, occluding the congregation. And they sang. They just stood there and sang. They sang so beautifully. And when they were done, I climbed this high pulpit and I delivered my 3-minute little sermon. And then I sat down and they sang. And we just did that. But I promise you, as they sang, I watched the congregation change. It was as if a wind blew over a wheat field. Because they started blowing forward. People literally started, you can see that, you know, it changes colors. People were moving forward each time. They were moving closer and closer forward. And so when I spoke love now, it wasn't something that I had to reach down, you understand, from in me. It was out in front of me. I mean, it was here. It was in the air. It was like plucking apples. It was just here. I was saying it. My words. But that didn't matter. The last song we did was Soon and Very Soon. Soon and very soon we are going to see people. And Timmy had verses that he sang on that. Big, huge, enveloping mattress person, Timmy, who stood in front and did not clap. He just stood there and sang with that generous voice of his. And on that song, Herman started leading us up. We always moved. We always did things that made sense, spiritual and symbolic sense. And Philip and I were behind, watching the choir shrink in front of us and then go out. And people, the congregation was on its feet and reaching and touching. Reaching and touching. In the front sat the pastor and the vicar. They had looked at their watches. They sat side by side, pepper shaker, salt shaker. And they kept sitting, but the congregation was touching this beautiful choir. I mean, touching. I understand that. So that Herman got delighted. Herman got a kick. He marched the choir right up to the balcony, and he sang from the balcony soon and very soon, and all the people were turned around. Ah, that's where they were, the balcony. He marched them on down and then marched them out of the church, never having them stop singing, and the people followed us. They followed us to the place we were going to take our clothes, change our clothes. And they said over and over again, we needed to hear this. This is true. We needed to hear this, they said. So our choir from that day forward, this was God talking to us. That choir had become the hosts. Those who had been the aliens became the hosts and welcomed these guests. And from the little child on up, you can talk to anyone in the choir. They will all remember this moment because it was in this moment that God said why we did what we did, why we stayed in white houses, many of them never having had a black person sleep in their beds before, why we sang, why we went to the odd places in the South or the North or the West. They all knew that. And Cheryl told the capper, she went into that dark sanctuary to gather up her music, and she heard someone going like this. And she looked, and guess who it was? It was that pastor. Cheryl said, see. I mean, we look for these signs all the time. She said, see. That night, the pastor said to me, well, you know, it's hard to get out of your comfort zone. One more thing. I wrote this in the book that's called As For Me In My House. I wrote it in there. And after that book was published, about 2 years, I got a letter. First, the fellow had called. He had telephoned. And he talked to Than, and she said, you want to leave a message? And he said, no, I'll write. And he wrote. And it started this way. He said, dear Walt, I am the little cardinal. That's what I called him in my... I was not very nice. He said, I am the little cardinal, he said. And then he apologized. He said, I'm sorry. I didn't know he caused such pain. And I wrote him back and I said, isn't this wonderful that you can write me your sorrow and I can write you God's forgiveness? Isn't this wonderful? And when I read that letter to the choir, they just cried. It was before we were about to do a concert several years later. And it was like affirmation. So the God who calls us, that's where the confirmation is beautiful. God who calls us confirms us in the call over and over again. There is time. There are 5 minutes before Vespers. Thank you.